Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Ruck. And today it's a Ruck special. I hope you caught Owen Slot and the guys with the normal weekly segment. Today, much more important, just me and the man sitting opposite me, Wayne Barnes, in my opinion. And this has been contested widely, the best referee that there is. And Wayne, on the verge of the Six Nations, is going to talk to us about how he sees it, whether he still loves it, and all the things that wind us up about referees. So it's a seven-hour programme this week. Just before we start, a massive big shout-out to Patrick Finn and Reading Colts rugby team preparing for their Sunday league match against Newbury in the BBO League. Good luck, guys, and especially to Alex Baxi-Bax, the conscience of the team. Six Nations is a tournament played under constant pressure. Obviously, the coaches, the players are under pressure, all aspects of it. Even now and again, the journalists are, because we have to file our stuff before all you guys out there have sipped your first pint, let alone downed it. But is there anyone under more pressure than referees? Wayne Barnes is with me, not looking particularly anxious, but Wayne, even with you, after 77 test matches, do the nerves start kicking in?
Well, first, thanks for the intro, Steve. Best referee in the world title. You know, all that brown envelope that I just passed in the table, obviously, did well. Very kind of you.
There's not much in it, but thanks anyway.
I'm from a Welshman, you know, it gets even better. You know, I don't get praise from a Welshman very often. And thanks for inviting me in. Been great to be here. One thing, though, Steve, if you don't mind me mentioning, you know, glass of water as I arrived. And I was listening to your podcast last week, and there was talks of bacon butties, there was talk of pasties, all down at Exeter. Nothing in sight.
There's a glass of water. We don't like to live up to our image when you're around, anyway. Oh. We can be washing and white. No, sorry, there is nothing in sight. And I'm afraid there's nothing afterwards either. But thanks for coming anyway.
Well, pleasure. And pressure, Steve. 77 in games. Yeah, they're all different. And the Six Nations always serves up something different. And that's, you know, a bit like you said, there's pressure on you, there's pressure on coaches, there's pressure on us. The more you do this, the slightly easier it gets, because you've got that experience to fall back on. You know, so, you know, take last year when you're over in France and, you know, against Wales at the end of it. A lot going on in that game. And you go back to your experiences. You think, right, what do I do in these situations? Who do I speak to? Which players are my, you know, my allies? And you work on that kind of knowledge and that experience that you've built up over the last 12 years of refereeing the Six Nations.
Did that incident at the end of the France-Wales game, where we're like sort of half an hour into injury time, but can anything prepare you for that? Because you've got the French props trying to replace each other, Slimani and Antonio. You've got a bloke running on who claims to be the French team doctor. I suppose he was the French team doctor. Then you're going back to penalty after penalty after penalty. Eventually the game is won. Is there anything more difficult than that, though?
Well, the Premiership is a good bedding for referees. You know, week in, week out, 22 rounds, we're really up against it. We've got some cracking teams, we've got some cracking coaches. You know, and that's why we're seeing a good young group of referees coming through from the Premiership. So you take that experience that you've got from there and take it into situations like Paris. So, you know, when you've got a doctor saying someone's injured, very hard for a referee who's not medically trained to say, no, he's not. You've got to trust those the medics on the day. You know, and that's something we've seen before in other games. And so on that day, I said, look, right, OK, you're the doctor. What are you telling me? And he said, he's injured. He needs a head assessment. So off he goes. And we had other things, you know, people, allegations of biting during that game. So, again, you go back to your experiences in the Premiership where, you know, we've had that before. We've had allegations made on the pitch. So you say, right, you tell me who did it and where he did it, and we'll have a look at it. And there wasn't no, you know, proof of that. So again, you're listening to the players, you're building that relationship with the players, you know, and that was, you know, George North came up to me, I knew he thought what had happened, and he said, Barnsley, can you check it? So of course you'll check it, because that relationship that's so special in rugby between the players and the referees was really evident that day.
It brings up another point there. Doesn't that come under the heading of appealing to the ref?
I think there's a bit of difference, isn't there? You know, if you've got the constant screaming of holding on, holding on, holding on, that becomes a plan. But, you know, you drop someone on your toe, the first thing you do is shout, ow! You know, it's an instant reaction. Someone jumps up and says, I've been bitten. It's not someone trying to buy a penalty. It's someone saying, I've just been bitten. Yeah. So I think as a referee, we want to keep that human side, and we want it to stay what's special about our sport. And what's special is me and Rob Howley after that match sitting down having a beer and chatting about it, or me and the French coach Guy Nové and Yannick Bruce sitting down and discussing what happened in that game. And we want those players to trust us, to use our nous on those kind of times, and that's what you've got to do on those big games.
Even for you, did it not? You've got whatever 70,000 Frenchmen screaming. You know the world's watching on TV. You've got Wales losing a game which they thought they'd won, and probably some of them probably think they deserve to win. Even for you, then, is there not something in the back of your head saying, "Oh my God, can I be somewhere else?"
Well, you start off of the day and you're looking around, and you listen to the Marseillaise, and then you listen to the Welsh anthem, and you don't want to be anywhere else. It's that special. You know what it's like down over in Paris, or down in Wales, which is really special when the roofs close and those the hymns and harriers start. There is nothing better, to be right in the middle on those days like that. It's a challenge, sometimes. You have to write a challenging piece. A player has to play a challenging game. That is a challenge, and you've got to step up to the mark on that, And you've got to trust your instincts. You've got to trust your experience. And, that's what I did on that day. And if you start thinking about what if and who's watching and what's going to happen there, you start making really bad decisions. You've just got to really take each decision on its own. And so you might have made... you make a mistake in the first minute of a game. If you dwell on that for the next 79 minutes, you're going to have a shocker. And this is what I always admire about the cricket umpires. How'd you go from, first session of day one, make a howler, and then day five, you're still making decisions. So, that's what you do on days like France.
We should have pointed out at the start, actually, that Wayne's a very successful barrister at Fulcrum Chambers. I looked him up on their website, and it said he prosecutes and also defends in cases. Is that the same case, or is that two different cases?
I'd be pretty talented to prosecute and defend. I could predict those cases, Steve.
Arguably even greater achievement than a high-flying barrister career is that you are the record holder for the Premiership. You've refereed more games, 191 in the Premiership, than a guy who was your hero and who had the old record of 190, which was Chris White. Now, 191 games in the Premiership. You look back there, he's serious? He could possibly have done that many games and still be alive?
That just means you've been around a long time. It's like you. How many times have you written in the Sunday Times?
But I don't have to have Cockers and Dean Richards and John Kingston screaming at me after. Is there anything, in a way, I'm not talking about the class of the competition, although I think it's really good, is there anything more difficult than that once you've done that? Are even internationals more difficult?
Some Premiership games, and you look at some of the games that I've been involved in, the Leicester Northampton games, some cracking finals, even just Exeter Sarahs a couple of years ago. They're special games. Exeter down at with Sarahs down them in the semi final last year. All those games are Test match, intensity, and you learn your Test match ability from those games down in Sandy Park or at Allianz or at Welford Road. So, it's a great grounding. But 191 games, I first kicked off down in Bath, down at the Rec back in 2003. You never think I'll still be doing this in 15 years' time.
Sure.
But still massively enjoy the challenge. And what it allows you to do is step up to those big occasions like Marseille and round three of the Six Nations. Does it get much better than that?
Sure. Do you think that the general rugby public and rugby players and coaches actually know anything more about the laws than they did in the old days? Because it must cheese you off when you give a decision, it's correct, the tit judges know it's correct, but everyone in the crowd thinks it's wrong. Do you ever think, for God's sake, get a life and read the law book?
I also think that we've got a job to do as referees. If we start giving decisions which are really technical and no one understands apart from us, then is it really the right decision? So, the best referees out there, I think, are the ones who give a decision, explain it, don't go into, chapter and verse, but a one-liner. So, my mum who's sitting up in the stand with the ref link ears on knows what I'm giving it, or the punters who are sitting at home because they can't get a ticket know exactly what it's for. So I think we've got a job to do. And, you know, and the best players in the world, I have no doubt they know the law book inside out. And that's why, you know, I know he wasn't everyone's, not everyone thought he was always on the right side of the law. But there was a reason why Richie McCaw was so good at the breakdown. And he knew the law book inside out. And he would challenge you as a referee. And he would say, you sure on that one? And often he would be right and you'd be wrong.
God, he was right a heck of a lot of times for a guy who played close to the wind. Let's say that anyway. On the subject of dissent from the touchlines, etc., and us not knowing the laws or knowing some of the laws, etc., there's a number of areas which really wind people up. Probably the people at home watching on TV or the people in the crowd who paid their, you know, they've probably got a right to complain. They paid all that money. But for a start, can you just take us through what's going to happen now between now and the Six Nations in terms of your preparation? Do you get together with all the other referees to standardise everything?
Yeah. So what's been great over the last probably 12 months, we started to develop the relationship with the coaches as well. So on Wednesday of this week, so 10 days out before the Six Nations, all the Six Nations coaches, the top three or four referees who are available at the moment are all sitting down over at Heathrow for a chat to discuss how November looked. Were we on the right track as referees? Are there any items that need tightening up? Are there anything that needs changing that we've got time to change? And a really nice example of that was post-Six Nations last year. We all sat down and said, what did the Six Nations look like? And the Southern Hemisphere boys came up as well. And it was clear that there was something wrong with the laws with the Italy-England situation, you know, because it didn't look right. It wasn't good for the game. Italy really smart and played the laws to a T. But there was a general consensus among the coaches that we need to change this, we can't have this. We sat down and said, well, how about we try and introduce this new law? And you've seen it this year where there's an offside line now at the tackle. You know, as long as one man is standing over, that creates an artificial ruck. We have an offside line. So that can't happen this year. So we're seeing the game evolve really quickly when there's a need.
But just before you go on from that, I'd say, look, of all the people who infringe the laws sometimes deliberately and get away with it, Italy were just playing the law book. I thought they were wonderful.
It was a great piece of mastery of the law book. Yeah. But there was a decision, you know, between the coaches. This wasn't, you know, the referee saying this is outrageous. This was a coach who's sitting down in a room saying, we need to change this. And, you know, the great coaches are the ones who get the laws and just, you know, find a little, you know, a little inroad into them. And they'll be doing that now with the new laws. There was a general feel that that wasn't what we wanted to see on a rugby pitch. And so there was a little amendment in the laws on the back of that.
But why would you allow the coaches to do that? I mean, when it comes down to it, I know you should be in contact with them for standardisation and to answer their queries. But at the end of the day, you are policing the law book, maybe with a certain lightness of touch. But why should they have a say? Because if I'm Eddie Jones and I was kind of my coaching was humiliated that day, I don't want it to happen again.
Yeah,
but I mean that's only because he got stung.
But if all the other coaches said, well, you know, yeah, we don't believe there is an issue, then it wouldn't have changed. But this was a consensus in the room among the, you know, all the top coaches in the world. And you use the word policeman. It's not for the policeman to decide what the laws of the street are. You know, they go and police them, and that's what we do. You know, we listen, we give our expert opinions, and then we go out and police those laws.
You haven't had the meeting yet, but what sort of areas will you be going into when all the Six Nations refs get together?
So that's with the coaches, and then on the back of that the following week, so we'll be about 4 or 5 days out from Six Nations. That's when everyone starts to come in from the north and the south, and we'll sit down as a group, take on board what the coaches have asked us to prioritise. But, you know, you won't be surprised. It'll be the tackle and the breakdown will be top of the list, because that's what creates a cracking game. If you get quick ball, you know, of course defence is allowed to slow and legally slow if they're on their feet. But if you get rid of that negative tactic, you could lie on the wrong side and we get teams attacking. So we'll definitely look at the breakdown. We'll look at the set piece. We'll look at scrum. Always look at scrum and how do we make sure that teams aren't negative, and we're trying to encourage teams to play away from eight so we get, you know, those big eights. You know, we want to see those eights picking off and launching great attacks off the scrum. So we'll be looking at how we can make sure that the scrum is a positive aspect of the game. And I'm sure that the driving maul is going to be something that we see a bit more of. And we saw a little bit over the weekend in Europe of what an attacking weapon that can be. And we saw, I mentioned Exeter Saracens earlier on in this podcast. And what an attacking weapon that was in the 79th minute of the semi-final of the Premiership. You know, so I think we'll see a bit of discussion around that as well.
Can I give you another attacking weapon? The scrum used to be an attacking weapon. It's still supposed to be the engine of the game, and it's still in the philosophy of the World Rugby on their site as one of the precepts of the game. Why should the number eight play away from the scrum? If the ball's at my feet and I'm the number eight and I fancy taking them on, why have I got someone, the ref in my ear, tell me to play it? I want to keep the ball there. And if I can drive it 5 yards or even 1 yard, I want to do so. Why should I play away from the scrum?
Oh, I totally agree on that, Steve. If you've got a team who are looking to go forward and it's starting to move forward, we should encourage that. And we saw a fantastic piece of scrummaging this weekend over in Munster. You know, we saw that as an attacking weapon. And if teams are going forward, we'll encourage it. We'll say, you know, you carry on. If you want a penalty from it, that's a coaching decision. If you want to go forward and then launch, you know, a great attacking move from eight. But what was happening, and one of the reasons we've encouraged teams to move the ball away at eight, is we're having the ball rolled in. It was sitting in the tunnel and we're having 10, 15 seconds of nothing. No one going forward, no one hooking the ball. So we've said, you've got to hook the ball. One of the new laws of from the start of the season. And once you hook the ball, if it gets to number eight and it's clearly stationary, you get an opportunity to use it. But as soon as it's stationary, we're not just going to wait there for 10, 15 seconds until someone gives up. Because what usually happens is either the ground gives up or both of them gives up at the same time, and then we have a mess and we've lost a minute of the game. And we want to see the ball in play. Keep the power of the scrum, but just make sure it's, you know, a team who are trying to attack going forward, not just keeping the ball sitting there.
But I still think, look, when you're asking someone to play the ball at the back of a ruck, fair enough, eventually they're going to do it. They've got to do it because the ruck's on the floor. They're not going anywhere. But if I'm going to drive and I think I've got the better scrummage, I can't get my drive on in 2 or 3 or 4 seconds. I'm going to need 5 or 10 seconds to get it on. Am I not allowed to do that anymore?
Yeah, so what the law says is you hit the ball as soon as it gets to number eight, so you can keep it in the second row for as long as you want. You know, if you're skillful enough team, you think you're going to use this as a weapon, hook it, get it to the second row. You know, Sarahs do this really well. You know, they'll wait, they'll keep it in the second row. If they feel that they've got an edge, they'll then start moving it forward.
Okay.
And they'll walk forward with a ball in the second row. But what was happening, and the reason why we're encouraging eights to move the ball away, is it was getting to number eight. It was stopping. There was no movement whatsoever. Teams were trying to go. You know, there was huffing and puffing, waiting, and then they'd try and go again. And we're like, okay, you've had your chance now. You've had your chance. Now it's time to play away. But we don't want to get rid of the scrum and attacking weapon, you know. And that's why I still spend more days in coffee shops and wine bars with Phil Keith Roach trying to understand the scrum than I do probably at home with a family.
Sure. I'm sure that's right. That's what Polly said to me the other day, actually. You're always talking about scrummage. Okay, but this, just to clarify something, you're there to referee the game. You're there to keep a big eye on safety, but you're not actually there to make it an attractive game. Because maybe I don't want an attractive game. I'm stronger than the other team, so I actually want to play it fairly tight. Are you sure you're not now only giving teams one way to play?
Now, it's always interesting when you come up against a team. You know, you think you play against someone like Wasps at the moment, and they're going to want quick ball. They're going to want to get it out 10, 12, 14, 15 as quickly as they can. You know you're going to come up against teams who say, well, we want to play a bit more direct. We want to pick and go around the fringes. It's not for me to decide how a team plays.
Okay.
But what we've got to do is say, well, if you're going to play a pick and drive game, the laws are really clear. You can't just run in and everyone jump on top of the ball, you know, and stop a contest at the breakdown. You've got to arrive up. But we'll also say to the team who are trying to defend against a team who want to pick and drive, you've got to be onside. So, you know, we go into games really well prepared, knowing what each team might you know, provide for that game. So if you're going to have a team who are going to play the ball away from eight all the time, you know the teams who do that, you know, just from simply, you know, looking at the last few games, you might think, well, they're going to hook the ball quickly, and so you're going to make sure that the defensive line of the defence are 5 metres, because they're going to want to get into that 10 and that 12 earlier on. So we've got to prepare for every style of play. We prepare for specific teams, but it's not for me to say what the right way play. You know, we all know what we enjoy, and growing up in Gloucestershire, there was nothing better than a wet driving mall over at the Shed End. You know, that was always great to see.
I'm glad you said that. in my opinion, the easiest thing to referee must be to put the putter in the scrum, because you're standing there, it's so obvious, you've got a nice tunnel and you can work out what's halfway. Now, we know it doesn't work like that, but have we not gone too far now? Because you once told me that it's got to be, what's the word you use, credible.
Credible,
well, yeah. It's not credible. If I'm going to put the ball in, I take a big step to my right, then I turn sideways and I throw it under the feet of the second row. What's happened to that?
Yeah, look, well, this is the thing that we get asked about perhaps most when you're going around. You know, you go and sit in your local rugby club and some old boy will come up to you and put his arm around you and say, when are you going to put the ball in straight? And we understand that. And that was one of the things that we definitely haven't done well over the last few years. And this was one of the law changes which I think has helped us. We're saying now to hookers, they've got to hook the ball, you know, because what we're seeing is a ball just being rolled into the second row or even kneed into the second row. So what we said is, because the teams have infringed, so one team's knocked on, we'll give the team who are putting in the ball a bit of an advantage. And by that we mean he can step with his shoulder. So if the team tends to be on the loose head side, his left shoulder, the nine's left shoulder, needs to be in line with that middle line. So if you can imagine that, he's then got to put the ball in straight, not crooked, as you said, twisting your body to one side and hoying it into the second row, but he's got to roll it in so the hooker then sweeps the ball backwards. And what this also helps is get the ball back to what, eight or into the second row and win possession more quickly. And I think we saw that in November. We saw all of the home nation teams hooking the ball. So they've adjusted to it. Nines are starting to adjust to it, because you talk to some hookers, they actually don't want it in now skew if they're trying to hook the ball. They actually want to be able to heel it properly. And I think Six Nations last year, the scrums weren't always great, but hopefully this year with this introduction of the hook, we should see the ball down the middle. We should see the ball being hooked. And there's pressure coming on from us, from, you know, my international boss is Alan Rolland, the ex-Irish test referee. He's not just sweeping it to the side and saying, don't referee it. He's saying, this is one of your priorities, go out and referee it. And again, back to the coaches. Coaches, when we sit in the room, will be saying, we want it hooked. You know, Eddie is one of the big advocates of it. You know, he had the ball being hooked in Japan. He's come into England and made the ball be hooked. And he's saying, it's a law, referee it. And the coaches have bought into that, and we've got to buy into that as well.
Will he back you up? Will everybody back you up, though, if whoever's doing the first game, first scrum, when I still think the scrum half turns to a side, would he say, look, I've told you about that, it's a free kick?
It's always what we say to the coaches. You're asking us to referee this. If we referee this and it bites your team on the backside, are you going to support us? And unanimously, they always say yeah.
Okay. I hope they're put to the test then in that case. You and I have spoken about rear feet offside. For instance, the guards, the props, the defensive props are always a yard up at least in front of the advantage line. I also get the impression that there's so many phases that teams hardly ever retreat beyond the advantage line before coming up for the next phase. And also that when teams are playing rush, the outside centre is so far up in front before the scrum half lifts the ball, that you might as well give him a jersey to the opposition. Now, your point is, your point was when we spoke about it, is that I'm wrong, and actually people are onside.
Yeah, look, I think a couple of things there, Steve. First of all, we said if we want a decent game of rugby, we've got to create quick ball at the tackle. We can't have players lying all over the top of it. If teams get quick ball, then they're not going to do anything if they haven't got space to use it. So we've got to create space. And that means starting from the back foot, making sure those guards are onside so the nine isn't scragged as soon as he picks up the ball, and then making sure those defences come off the line legally. And one of our priorities has been and will be going into the Six Nations will be space. You've got to work hard to go after these guards to create space. What always amazes me, I've come off many a game, and there's certain teams who have that rush defence, and Saracens are a good example of it, where you come off and you think, they must have been offside though. Yeah. They must have been. And, you know, those are the teams who we've discussed, and you say, oh, come on, it must be the outside centre. And you go down, you sit down, because we review the games every week in Twickenham. You know, I'll sit down with Spreader as my coach, and Tony Spreadbury, the ex-international referee. We'll always look at that. I'll always say we need to just make sure that they're legal. And you freeze the point where that number nine picks up the ball, because that's when the ball becomes out, as soon as it's lifted. And then the amount of times that that 12 or 13 is offside, you can count on one hand. If you miss one a game, it's surprising, because you've got your assistant referees out there having a look. You've got me saying, well, that ball's now lifted. And their timing, you know, and people like, Andy Farrell over in Ireland now, he's got his teams defending legally. They'll give half a metre at the back foot, and then they will rush. And so by the time the 10's got the ball, the 12 or the 13 is already in his opposite number's face. And it's unbelievable, the skill that these teams, and you know, and the time and preparation they spend on it.
Okay, so it's unbelievable skill, not miles offside. I respect what you say. I still think that, considering the number of breakdowns and the number of opportunities to be offside, the number of penalties that are given in the course of a season on so vital a rule is very, very low. It's very, very low. But you're saying they're just being professional and they're...
Yeah, last weekend I was over in Ulster, Ulster versus La Rochelle, and we penalised La Rochelle three times in the first half for offside. And it tended to be that guard, as you said, you know, just halfway up and then just putting pressure on the nine. My ARs were saying, you've got to put pressure on them now. Mm. We spoke to them after three penalties and said, look, you're shutting down the space. You want to play an open and free-flowing game, you've got to open up the space. And they went in at half-time and they adjusted. And they were half a metre behind the back foot at that point. And we've got to officiate that, and we've got to referee that. And that's what we did on that day. And we created more space in the second half.
Do you trust your every assistant referee? Do you have to put your trust in them? Because there is so much for you to look at. Do you have to trust your assistant referees to call offside?
Yeah, it's like asking a 10, do you trust your 9? You know, that relationship is so special on the pitch, and it's so special between us. Not just the assistant referees as well. It's a team of four, you know, with the TMO as well these days. You know, they're in a really good position to see if a player has never got back onside, to use one of your kind of questions. The difficult ones for them is just knowing when the ball's lifted. So obviously they're looking across the line to see if the ball's lifted and then they're offside. But an assistant referee comes in and says to me, Barnsley, they're offside.
Yeah.
He's certain. He's not saying I'm guessing it. He's saying I'm 100% certain here, and I will take that 100% of the time.
Okay, but if he says that, does he tell you that at the next breakdown, or will you blow the whistle there and then?
He'll tell me live. I'll stick my arm out, say play advantage, right, and we'll go back, and he'll tell me where. And that has to be right for the team of four. You can't be second guessing, thinking, oh, do I trust him? Do I not? You know, we know each other so well. You know, first weekend, France versus Ireland, me and Nigel Owens are working together. Nigel in the middle, me on the touchline. You know, Nigel and I've probably run touch for each other 50-odd times. Mm. He sang at my wedding.
Mm. What did he sing?
That's a good one. How great thou art. He did the English version rather than the Welsh version.
Okay.
Up in the chapel in Lincoln's Inn.
Oh, amazing. He's an amazing bloke.
Yeah, he's a fantastic friend, fantastic bloke. Bloody good singer as well.
Okay.
Those are the relationships that we have, you know, and you get to know each other. And so, you know, when I call in offside, or if I call in offside France versus Ireland, he'll take it. He'll say, well, of course I trust him. You know, that's the trust that we've built up over years.
What about the vexed question of the breakdown? Just for people who are watching on TV and not breakdown experts, etc., what have they got to look for in terms of people staying legal? And what are the first things that you look for when there's a breakdown?
So the first thing is always clearing the tackle area. So you have a tackle, sometimes really easy, because the tackling player, the bloke who makes a tackle, falls to the correct side. So he's got his back towards his own try line. Often, though, particularly with offensive tackles where they've won that contest, they will fall towards the ball and towards the opposition's try line. We've got to get him out of the way really quickly, because if he slows Nine's ball down, if Nine gets there and he's got to step over a player who's there, or he's got to pick up a body and move the ball, they've already done the damage. So the first thing we always look for is that channel, Nine's channel being cleared. So you would expect a few penalties in a game for that, because any doubt, we'd say get out of the way. Don't be lying there.
But you are saying there's a certain dispensation for a guy who's made a tackle, won the contest, and he just happens to come down on the other side.
Yeah.
So he's got to really get away quickly before the opposition come in.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, and if you think about it, if you get a dominant tackle, he's going to have an extra half second anyway, because the attack probably have to come around that extra half second to get in a decent position. But so we're saying, once you fall on the wrong side, don't just lay there. Do something positive and don't roll into Nine. Don't trip Nine up as you roll away. So always our priority is getting that tackler out of the way. And next, we're looking at how the players arrive. So you take that offensive tackle. the attacking team under a bit of pressure. What we don't want them doing then is all jumping on the ball, you know, stopping a contest. So we want them arriving. You know, you've heard talk about arriving up, planes arriving up. So that kind of positive body shape to make sure that they're doing something positive. So how do players arrive? Both in attack, but defenders. Defenders who want to go and get the ball. You know, those great sevens, you know, the Pococks, you know, the Hoopers from Australia, you know, are straight on the ball almost instantaneously. But we want them in a position where they can maintain their body weight. So it's not, you know, flat like a pancake and then running their feet underneath them. It's going straight on the ball, contesting the ball, trying to turn it over that way. So we're looking for tacklers getting out of the way and then arriving players staying on their feet. And then have a bit of a competition for the ball. If the player gets cleaned out, then we play on. The ball's available. He's done his job. He slowed it. If he's still tugging on the ball 2-3 seconds later, he probably deserves a bit of reward of a turnover.
But what if the ruck's been formed, though? After 3 seconds, there might be a ruck formed.
As long as he's got his hands on there before a ruck's formed, he can stay on there all day.
Right.
Okay. Obviously, he probably should get a penalty after a couple of seconds. But what we'd say, get his hands on the ball. He can keep them on there until either he's taken off the ball by, you know, just being losing that competition, or he comes up with the ball and just turns it over, or he gets a holding on penalty. But he can keep his hands on there, and even if a ruck then forms around him.
But do you think that actually the jackler gets too much of the benefit of the doubt? Because the man in the street, if I try and stand or sort of bend down, and actually I've got my hands out there and I'm sort of leaning forward and trying to pull the ball, my sort of central core would collapse in about 1 second. Are you sure? Are we sure that none of these jacklers are actually taking a nice ride on bodies?
Well, I'm not going to comment about your central core, Stephen, but I reckon
not many people do.
You have a look at some of these talented players around international at the moment. You know that seven who's just come into the squad from Scarlets, the Davis, one of the Davis brothers,
James Davis.
He's not the tallest. But geez, you can get low to the floor. You know, you take a Tipperick, you take a, you know, the Scottish, the Barclays, the O'Briens, all these, you know, the Underhills, the Robshaw, all these players that we're going to see over the next couple of weeks, they have immense core strength.
Sure.
Now, what we can have, you know, if their feet are, you know, 6 feet behind their hands, then they're probably not supporting their body weight. But if they're in a strong position, and we're looking at that, you know, almost upside down V, aren't we, kind of position, then they train for this. They are so skillful at this. And not only do they have to get in that body position, they have to withstand someone coming in, trying to move them out of the way by grappling them, trying to roll them, hitting them backwards. And if they stay on that ball, they probably deserve a bit of reward there.
IRB, World Rugby's now became, they at one stage cracked down on, because in the Super 12, they just wanted continuity of possession. But what you're saying is, you want continuity of play. You're not trying to keep the guy in the team in possession to keep it ad infinitum.
Yeah, we want to reward good skill, and good skill is getting your hands on the ball, you know, picking up the ball, surviving that clean out, turning it over, and giving it your nine. You know, nothing. We see New Zealand. How many tries do they score off a quick turnover where, you know, two passes and then the winger's in? You know, so we want to reward that good skill, and we want also reward it by penalty if he's still holding on and they haven't cleaned him out. So that should be rewarded as good as, you know, a team who just keep hold of possession.
You're listening to The Ruck, a special today. We'll be back in a minute. Wayne, you, as well as all your responsibilities, you're now responsible for the safety of players if you didn't have enough on your plate. There's something called the seatbelt tackle, which has now come in, and I'm looking all throughout the law book. I can't find it in there. How do things appear out of nowhere when they're not laws? Because that sounds like you're making up a law as you go along in your meetings.
Well, I don't reckon this came from referee. I reckon this came from Ben Kay. I reckon I was listening to BT one night and he started to call it a seatbelt tackle. And now everyone else has started to call it a seatbelt tackle. And even I've heard referees calling it a seatbelt tackle on TV. I guess it's just one of those, you know, terms that comes into rugby. You know, many a time I've been spoken at by Brian Moore, who's told me there's nothing like a hit. Where's the hit in a book for a scrummage? I'm like, I understand, Brian. I won't use it anymore.
Yeah.
So a seatbelt tackle is just, I guess it's a terminology that started to come in where, you know, someone will go over the top of the shoulder, catch the neck as part of that making a tackle, and it's been termed a seatbelt tackle. But I'll give you an assurance, Stephen, I won't use it from now on.
Good man. We'll be monitoring that carefully. On a serious note, high tackles and people being taken out in the air, it no longer, to be penalised, I no longer have to be... I don't even have to be, as well as not being, don't have to be illegal. I don't even have to have any sort of intent to cause harm, and I don't have to be reckless. I can come up and purely for because of the angle of the two players, I can be penalised and also red carded, can't I?
So split them into two if we can. So we got the high tackles. You remember last year there was this change in kind of terminology which came from World Rugby, and everyone was petrified we were going to see, you know, red and yellow cards spoiling the Six Nations. Mm. There wasn't one yellow or red card in the Six Nations for a high tackle last year, which was great to see. And it probably meant that players changed the way that they tackled, you know, and you listen to how some of the defensive coaches were coaching. They were saying, you know, we're going to tackle a bit lower, we're going to go in without a swinging arm, maybe a swinging lower arm. So we saw a change in that. And what we were saying to players is just protect your opposite man. Don't go hitting ball or above height in a tackle. Hit below the ball. So if a player just ducks slightly, of course you're not intending to hit him, but you did, you know, and they can do some damage. You know, you get a shoulder into the head, you know, you're going to cause a lot of damage. So we've got that with high tackles. What we're saying is tackle lower and you're not going to hit someone in the head. And then the man in the air is a slightly different one. You've got to know that if you kick the ball up in the air and start chasing it, a fullback is going to jump up and catch it. So you can't just keep your eyes closed and run straight through a player who's jumping. You've got to be aware that someone's going to go into the air. We're not saying don't contest the ball, you know. Look at Israel Folau, you know. Look at Mike Brown, you know. Some of the great players who kick the ball up and go and challenge. And there's nothing better that gets, you know, the people off their seats at Twickenham, you know, where, you know, Brownie kicks a ball up in the air, runs, chases it, leaps in the air like a salmon, catches the ball and carries on running. It's a great piece of skill and, again, should be rewarded. But what we're saying is, you know, we go back, I guess it was 4 or 5 years ago when Ulster played Saracens and Jared Payne went underneath Alex Goode. Where Alex went up in the air, Jared just ran through him, didn't intend to do it at all. But Alex fell on his head and went off in a stretcher. Sure. So we're saying you've got to be aware that if you kick the ball up in the air, that a player's going to go up in the air. So either go up and contest, so you're not then making that pivot point to where the player's going to spin. You're going to go shoulder to shoulder if you hit him, or wait till he lands and then drive him backwards. Just make a decision early on.
Okay, let me tell you the thing that drives me the most nuts. The chat show. Everybody's talking. Everybody's talking, everybody's appealing, everybody's arguing. Now, you've got this gift of being able to referee 30 blokes under pressure and still go around telling everybody of those 30 why you made the decision you did, which is very, very, which is just maestro stuff. But you can blow your whistle, you can take people back 10 yards, and everyone's got to shut up. And you can do that for anyone chatting. And there's a difference between chatting and asking for clarification. Anyone chatting, anyone appealing, even if it's the outside centre, you can blow the whistle, send them back 10 yards. Why don't you use that?
I think we're seeing it more. It's something that Premier Rugby is really keen for us as Premiership referees to highlight. And we've gone into the clubs and coaches and said from the start of the season, look, if we get players appealing, if we get players constantly waving their arms in the air, don't be surprised if you go back 10 metres and it keeps on going, we'll get rid of someone. And so we have seen an increase in the amount of penalties and the amount of... you know, plus tens. We still want to have that relationship with a player. We still want to be able to say to him, look, I understand you might be a bit frustrated, but there's no need to shout at me. You know,
but hasn't he got to work on the relationship as well as you? Why is it the only relationship? Only one person's putting any effort into it.
No, I agree. And, you know, when you get a player who then does it again, then he shouldn't be surprised when he goes back 10. And, you know, often you'll say, look, come on, mate, I haven't shouted at you like that all game. And he'll say, yeah, get your point. And that's it. That's done. It's nipped in the bud. And that's...
Okay.
But when you get teams you constantly want to chirp or constantly want to appeal, then we have to draw a line in the sand. Because, you know, what makes our game special, and I think why we want our kids to play it and we, you know, we want our sponsors want to get involved in it, is the core values of it. And one of the core values is that, you know, there's that respect between the players and the referees, and, you know, and we don't want people shouting and screaming at the referee for 80 minutes. We want his decision, her decision to be fine. Of course, a clarification, because that, again, what makes it special. We said we'd do it in the Premiership. We said we'd do it in Europe. You know, this weekend someone came to me in the Scarlets game and asked for a yellow card for an opposition number. Mm. And I said to him, well,
quite right. Yeah.
You know, if you want that, you can have the card, not him. Mm. I think we have to make sure that that doesn't creep into the game.
Definitely.
And if we see it in the Six Nations, I know again when we meet as with the coaches on Wednesday and when we meet as the international refs the following week, we will be saying we've got to protect what's special about our game. And, you know, we're custodians of it as referees.
Just taking you back when you played in the Forest of Dean, and when you started your career there, we used to have this thing called a ruck. People used to drive into the breakdown. Very few people lay on the ground, as we know, because I'm not saying they were deliberately stamped, but they were likely to get some studs because they were lying on the ground and they tended not to do it. When you consider how many problems would be alleviated with the return of the ruck, it's incredible. You wouldn't have to have a boring round the corner. The jackhole probably, you know, wouldn't be a factor. And also, because teams had to commit to the ruck to drive it forward, you wouldn't have the field wouldn't be crowded with people. Do you ever see a day when we have a proper ruck? And I don't mean kick it in the head. I mean a ruck that can be policed, driving over the top, quick ball.
I was down in Lydney this weekend, actually, Steve, down at the rugby club at a friend's 40th party, and I was having a similar discussion with some people down there. I think they just wanted to kick people again, mind. I don't think it was anything to do with open, free, fast rugby. I think we've got to police it as referees. As I go back to that tackle conversation, if we clear the breakdowns and nines ball is available, then we're doing our job, we're doing our part, and we don't need to go back to the days where if someone falls on the wrong side, everyone runs over them, because people saw that, you know, and we saw the scars on Delalio's back at the end of that Lions game back in, or New Zealand game back in 2000 and whenever it was. You know, we want this to be an all-inclusive game. We want, you know, our kids to play it. We want, you know, mums and dads to look at a game on TV and say, yeah, that's the kind of game I want my kids to play. And I don't think that running over the top of people is that kind of game. But that means there's a huge onus on us as referees to say, anyone on the wrong side, we're going to penalise them if they stay there. Anyone who's continually on the wrong side, they can go and have a rest for 10 minutes. We won't allow it. We're not going to say, well, you know, he's just fallen the wrong way. And that's why, you know, whenever we sit down, tackle is always the key, and the tackler rolling away is always the key. So though I still have some wonderful memories of, you know, Breen versus Burial derbies, you know, and people coming off afterwards, you know, can't slap each other on the back because it's too sore. You know, I think those days are gone, and, you know, I'm quite glad I still play once a year, that it has gone, if I'm honest, Steve.
Fair enough. You're in the 70s now, Wayne, in terms of internationals. Do you think the three figures is possible?
If you'd have asked me when I did the first one, which is Six Nations, actually, it's quite nice. This year, France versus Italy I'm doing.
And then Ireland, Scotland?
Yeah, and then Ireland, Scotland. France and Italy was my first Six Nations back in 2007. If you'd have asked me if I'd have got to, you know, double figures back then, it would have been a surprise. I do 50 and to pass Chris was extremely special. And, you know, 70-odd now. Again, it just means I'm getting old. Oh, it's a long way off, you know. I'm looking forward to this Six Nations. The next World Cup's only, you know, 18 months away now. If I can get to that, that'll be my fourth World Cup. That'll be a special time, you know, make some special friends, see a fantastic country in Japan. We'll see what happens after that.
And do you still love it?
I love it a bit.
Is that the wrong word?
I love it a bit. I'm really excited now, knowing that, you know, we're 10 days out from the greatest rugby competition, you know, annual competition in the world. I'm off to Paris, I'm off to Marseille, I'm off to Dublin, I'm off to Cardiff. You know, does it get better? You know, think of a rugby fan if you had those four trips. I'm going to be standing in the middle of the pitch listening to those anthems. And I get to work with the best coaches, the best players, and, you know, and I get to meet my mates who are the best refs in the world as well. It's a pretty lucky job. And I get to meet you, Jonesy, obviously.
I know. Well, it took time for me to talk back to you, but in the end, I graciously consented. Wayne Barnes, I know you're incredibly busy with all your jobs. I worked out the other day the money you've probably lost by not being a full-time barrister. And it's more than I can ever earn, that's for sure.
But can you just remind the RFU of that, Steve, perhaps?
I'm going to do it as soon as I left the studio. And just a final note, don't forget to subscribe to us via iTunes. You can leave a message for us or response to us on iTunes as well. Or else we have our own site note that you can write to for all comments, all good and bad. It's theruck@thetimes.co.uk.
I'll be writing it onto that now, Steve. Don't worry.
Wayne Barnes, thanks very much for coming in. We wish you all the best with your two games in the Six Nations and definitely into the next World Cup and hopefully beyond. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Steve.
Welcome to Bose Recommends. This is the place to discover your new favorite podcast. Every week, we listen to hundreds of shows to bring you our favorites. And this is one we think you're going to love.
This really is the stuff of horror movies.
It's one of the hardest things I've had to do as a journalist.
Okay, he appears to have been arrested. What is going on here?
Hi, I'm Maeve McClenaghan, and I'm delighted that The Tip-Off is part of Bose Recommends. I'm an investigative journalist. And here in the UK, we have a long and proud history of digging deep and exposing wrongdoing. There's a lot that goes into making good investigative journalism. And I know from personal experience that sometimes the stories behind the news headlines can be just as fascinating as the finished articles. So I started The Tip-Off. Each episode, we dig into some amazing real-life detective stories.
It's hard. This job is really hard.
But you start to question everything you know.
Slightly in some sick way live those moments when your adrenaline is going.
There's car chases, slammed doors, dead bodies, leaked documents, meetings in dimly lit bars, and much more. So if you're curious about the complicated and mind-boggling detective work that goes into an investigation, then this is the podcast for you. Listen and subscribe on Acast, iTunes, or your favourite podcast app. Thanks to Bose for letting me tip you off, and for their support of podcasts in general. Bose, get closer.
That was this week's Bose Recommends, the place to discover your new favourite show. If you want to find out how you can enjoy podcasts in even better sound quality, visit bose.co.uk. Bose, get closer.